I'm not drunk. I'm going to the doctor tomorrow. I've been having dizzy spells, and it is like being drunk without being drunk. And Tim had to help me out of the condo and into the car tonight. And yesterday I couldn't even get out of bed hardly. And I don't know what it is. It's probably some of my blood pressure medicine. It says on the bottle, may cause dizziness. And I thought, well, it sure did. Anyway, I'm an alcoholic named Helen Moore. And I haven't had a drink since December the 31st, 1964. I've got 47 years of sobriety, and next month it'll be 48. And that's quite a... One day at a time, that's been a long time. I never once thought it'd be that long between drinks, or until I didn't drink anymore. But anyway, I was born in Texas and grew up in New Mexico. And I had a regular childhood. My parents were good to me. I had two brothers, and one of them died sober years ago, and I used to pray for him. When I first came into the program, I knew he was bad. He was bad to drink, like I used to be bad to drink, and I'd pray for him. I'd pray for him every day, and he would call me. He traveled a lot for his job, and he had access to telephone, and he'd call in the middle of the night, and finally I got to the point where I'd just lay the telephone down on the pillow and go back to sleep. Then eventually he ran into a tree. He lived in Albuquerque, and he ran into a tree that grew there suddenly. You know how that goes. The cop said, AA or jail? And he chose AA. So he was sober for several years before he died. But anyway, and I was glad. My mother, the reason I knew he was in treatment, my mother called me, and she never called in the daytime. Remember, used to it cost a lot to call long distance in the daytime. And she called and said, your brother is in, I think she said Heartview in North Dakota. He lived in Minnesota at the time. And he wants you to send him a large book. So I sent him a large book. And he died still having that book. But anyway, getting back to my story. I had my first drink when I was a sophomore in high school. I was 15. And I don't remember it. It was no earth-shaking deal. I just remember that I had a picture of me sitting on the fender of a car, and we wore blue jeans in those days, and I had on blue jeans and this flannel shirt, and I had a cigar in one hand, big cigar in one hand, and a can of beer in the other. And that was it. That was my first drink. Later on, I began to love the effects of drink. I had no reason to drink, and people begged me not to, especially my mother-in-law. She was all the time saying, you aren't a lady if you get drunk. Well, I wasn't a lady because I got drunk a lot. I was bad to black out. One time out in California, I woke up going 80 miles an hour on a freeway in California, and I didn't know where the hell I was, and I had two crying kids in the back seat. And that didn't keep me from drinking, though. I didn't quit drinking for several years after that. But anyway, I got married when I was 20. I graduated from high school and went to college for a couple of years. And I got married when I was 20 years old with someone I had met 3 weeks before. And we were married for 4 months. He wanted to have a home and children, a family and children and so forth, and I wanted to party. So I divorced him. He called me one night. I was at my parents'. I had moved in back in with my parents. And he called me one night, and he begged me to go with him to Texas where his father lived, and his father had had a heart attack. And this is when my first selfish, self-centered part of me became apparent. I refused to go, and he cried, and it didn't bother me in the least. I'm sorry about that. I'm sorry. I'm sorry about a lot of things, but that's one of the biggies. And then later on, I married, and this time I was married for 45 years before we divorced. And there were times I know when he'd wished that we'd have divorced at four months, because he was part of my getting sober. I don't know why I drank, except that I liked it. I liked the effect. I liked the way I felt when I drank, and I didn't like the blackouts, but I thought that was just part of the thing that you paid, part of the price you paid for getting drunk. And anyway, I was a real party girl. And then I had a child, and I got married, and I had a child, and then I had another child, and the drinking settled down. I dare you to drink with a couple of kids hanging on all the time. We lived in New Mexico, and you couldn't buy liquor except at the liquor store, and a lady didn't go to the liquor store alone, so I took my kids. And my husband was transferred out to California, and I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. This is where I, pardon the expression, became an alcoholic. They sold wine every place in California, in the shoe store, the department store, the drug store, every place you turn. And I thought that was great because you had to go to the liquor store in New Mexico. And so I became a winette. Wine was my drink. And I had my 29th birthday. Now, when I first came to the program, I had a lot of trouble with step two about the word sanity. I thought, I am so sane and so smart. You know, I was real smart. And so smart and so forth. And here they say sanity. And I thought, I'm not insane. On my 29th birthday, I got drunk that day and felt sorry for myself. Self-pity was my main emotion in those days. Nobody had a sadder life than I did, you know. And you got to be kidding, because I was perfectly okay. I had a husband and children and a nice home, and yet I felt sorry for myself. And I said, okay, Helen, old girl, that's what I call myself when I drank. I said, Helen, old girl, you got one foot in the grave and the other on a banana peel. And the kids are growing up. They don't need you anymore. They were 5 and 3. And I didn't even have the third one. So anyway, that's the way I felt about myself, especially when I drank, and which was quite often. And the children never told on me, and neither did Howard, my husband. He said he used to back out of the driveway and think, who could he talk to that day to tell about the hell that was going on in our house because he'd come home and I was drunk. And he tried everything, you know. He tried taking away my money, and he tried taking away my checks, and he tried taking away my liquor. He'd pour it out, and we had a game we played. He'd come home, and he'd find the bottle, which I had hidden especially for him after I'd watered it down quite a bit, and he'd stand at the sink and pour it out with that self-satisfied look on his face, you know. And I thought, I've really got another one hidden away. And we were transferred to Louisiana, and it was more of the same. And we were transferred to Idaho, and we were 4 years in Idaho, and they have two seasons, winter and the 4th of July. And it even snowed one 4th of July. Anyway, we were transferred back to Texas then, and this was the beginning of the end. We were transferred to Texas City, and I was pregnant. Now, to say that I was unhappy about being pregnant is a misstatement. I was really upset. I was so mad, you know, because the kids were up big enough now that they were going to school and I could play bridge. What I really meant was I could drink and wouldn't be bothered with the kids. And now I was going to have this baby. And so there's a lot of pitiful things in this life, but one of the most pitiful is a drunk pregnant woman, and that was me. This was 1961, and Hurricane Carla blew up in the Gulf of Mexico, and we were right across the bay from Galveston, and it stayed out in the ocean and whirled around for several days. I was gone. They said they came by with, you know, loudspeakers and said, "Get out, get out, get out." I believed them, and I got out. And I had a neighbor who had been her husband was in the Coast Guard, and she had been in hurricanes before, and she told me what to save, like papers and pictures of the kids and so forth. And so that's what I did. I loaded up the station wagon and put the kids in the front and the cat and the dog. We had a big black dog in the back. And I left. Hell with it. I wasn't going to sit around for any hurricane. In fact, I lived in desert country, and I never heard of hurricanes, you know. And it scared me to death. And everybody thought it was crazy because I saved all this stuff. And then later, when another one blew up and we were ordered to leave again, everybody asked me what they should take. I wasn't as crazy as they thought I was. One of the things I would say to take is a pair of scissors. You'd be surprised how little things like a pair of scissors and needle and thread and so forth, it's no longer there, because that hurricane ruined us. We lost everything. Anyway, I went to Dallas, and on the way, I got stopped. We still had Idaho license plates. And I got stopped by a cop because there'd been a lot of looting. And he was just on duty, and he was all starched and perfect and clean and so forth. And he came and he put his elbow up on the car window like this, you know, and the dog crawled up across everything and came and started slobbering on his sleeve. And the kids started crying, "Mommy, what are you going to do? Are they going to put you in jail? What are we going to do? How are we going to be rescued? Blah, blah, blah." And he finally just said, "Go on, lady, go on." And so we went to this to our friend's house in Dallas, and we're there several days. we put the cat and the dog in a, with a, what do you call it, a vet, in a vet's place. And Howard came back to Texas City and on Wednesday, and when they allowed him back in, and I went and got the dog and the cat, and right across from the street from the vet was a liquor store, and I went and got some beer and vodka. It was 105 degrees, hot. God, it was hot in Dallas. And we had locked, I had locked us out of the house, and we couldn't get in, so we had to sit out in the yard, and I drank that vodka and some beer. And I was in a blackout when my husband called me that night to tell me that we had lost everything, that our house had been just, and then we'd been looted a couple of times, too. So I answered the phone, and I didn't know who he was. And then it dawned on me. I used to do that in blackouts. I would kind of come in and out, you know, just barely in the building, in the room. And finally he said, go on home to New Mexico and put the kids in school because we don't have any place to live. And so that's what I did. And there I was, pregnant, 5 months pregnant, and I embarrassed myself, my family, my friends, and it was a terrible time. It was an awful time. And then he called later and said that the company had an apartment that they were giving us, letting us rent for the time being, and I got to go back. And I think maybe the guilt and the embarrassment and the shame kept me from drinking. I didn't drink again until our baby was 6 weeks old. And she was fine. She was okay. And no alcohol syndrome. But anyway, I didn't drink for all those months. And I had a maid, and she came one day, and I went to the grocery store, and I bought some wine. And I came home and started drinking, and it was like I hadn't even quit, like I hadn't even gone those months without drinking. And in the fall of that year, or in the late summer of that year, we moved to a little town called Hitchcock, just outside Texas City, that was 17 feet above sea level, and we thought maybe we were safe. And we moved there, and we had a nice home, and people were very kind to us after the storm, after the hurricane. They bought a refrigerator for us, and one of the social things that I belong to had a baby shower for me in El Paso, Texas, and they sent me this huge box of stuff from the that people had brought. I had enough clothes for the baby for several weeks, and a lot of diapers and so forth. And someone else gave us a bed and a baby bed, and we made out real well after that. And we had the pictures of the baby, of the children, and we had the insurance papers. And my husband was an engineer, and he helped the insurance company helped the people set which had wind damage, and a lot of our wind damage was paid for, so we were lucky. And anyway, we finally got back on our feet about 3 years later. We were once again. But one time, we had to go to Houston to buy furniture because Texas City was just gone. I mean, you know, they didn't have anything. And one time, I remember I was pregnant and my ankles were swollen and I was so tired. And I sat down on a couch and started crying and saying I couldn't take another step. And we went home. I just, all of a sudden, had just given up. And there were a lot of people, and I know that this happened in this last storm, Hurricane Sandy, a lot of people just didn't bother. They just left. They said, it's not worth it. It's not worth it to try to build up again. And so I could sympathize the other day when they were going through that storm, because I knew exactly how they felt. It's just, it's a horrifying situation. I was glad eventually that we moved away from the hurricane part. Anyway, the baby was born, and things were going along. I was drinking, and one time I asked my doctor, we were friends, and I asked my doctor, I said, I'm worried about my drinking. And he said, how much do you drink, Helen? And I said, oh, a couple now and then. And he said, oh, if I didn't drink any more than that, I wouldn't worry about it. Now, he was talking about drinks, and I was talking about bottles. And there's a lot of difference. The other night at Telco, some medical students came, and we talked to them afterwards. And we said, don't ask, how much do you drink? Ask, do you drink when you're happy? Do you drink when you're sad? Do you drink after a rough day? Just find out when they drink, because you can't ask them, because if you ask them, we're going to lie about it, aren't we? I mean, nobody tells the truth about how much you drink, or at least I didn't, and I don't think you did either. And that's so embarrassing, you know. Can you imagine telling a doctor, I drink 2 bottles of wine every other day, and he'd say, huh? Well, anyway, so where was I? Y'all gonna have to forgive me. I'm 85 years old, so. Oh yeah, yeah, and then later on. These were the days where we had 12-step calls, and we were sent to a psychiatrist. Our doctor sent us to a psychiatrist. What happened was, is our middle daughter, and I have to tell you about my daughters, they all have little pouty lips, and when they cry, they tremble, and it's so sad, and the tears roll down the side of their face, and it just breaks your heart. And so our middle daughter began to have problems. It usually will happen with the children. And she wouldn't go to school one day, and she said she was sick. And I took her to the doctor, and he said, Helen, there's nothing wrong with her. Go home and see if something develops. So on this was on a Monday, and on a Friday, she stood at the kitchen door, and she was crying, that little lip quivering. And the tears rolling down, and she says, Mommy, I can't go to school, I'm afraid. And I thought, uh-oh. And I called the doctor, and he said, Helen, I'm going to send you to a psychiatrist over at the University of Texas Medical School was in Galveston. And he said, over to Galveston. And he's an older man, and he's a family psychiatrist. And so he sent us over there, and the two older girls and Howard and I went and left the baby and the dog at home. But anyway, we went over there, and she told her story. And there she was, 9 years old, and she was crying and so pitiful. And she said she couldn't go to school because she was afraid. She was afraid that someone would come in the house and kill her baby sister. She was afraid that the house would catch on fire and her mother wouldn't know what to do. She was just afraid. And the tears were rolling down her. And if I had been just a so-called, whatever a normal drinker is, I would have quit. But I'm an alcoholic and I have to drink. And so I didn't quit. This was in the fall of the year, but I was a very fortunate woman. The psychiatrist had a father in AA. He had 17 years of sobriety when I landed in his lap. And he immediately knew what was wrong. He immediately knew what was wrong. And so he started, he sort of just set me to the side and let me do what I would. And he got Howard and filled him with Al-Anon propaganda. And things began to change in our house. Whereas they'd always kept silent and not said anything, they all became tattletales. They told everybody. For instance, we ordered bicycles from Sears, and when they delivered them, I was in a blackout and sent them to a neighbor's house, and I didn't know which neighbor. And Howard had to go knock on doors, and people would say, well, what was the matter with Helen? And he said, she was drunk, of course. That became his favorite saying, she was drunk, of course. And like that was an everyday thing, which it was. And what? How's that? Is that better? Okay. Thank you. So anyway, they got the bicycles that year. And this was at Christmas time, and in February of the next year, Howard was chief engineer at this refinery, and they had what they called the lockdown every year, twice a year, and it was about 4 days. And they'd lock down everything and clean up the engines and so forth and get everything ready for another few months. And he had this lockdown, and he was gone for 4 days. Well, that was perfect for me. I emptied out a drawer in the chest of drawers and filled it up with wine bottles. And I stayed drunk. This was on a Thursday, and I stayed drunk until Sunday night. And I came to out of a blackout. And Howard was in the chair, and I was on the floor. And he said, Helen, I need a wife, and the children need a mother. And you're not doing either one of us any good. And he said, I want you to pack your little bags and get the hell out of here. And I knew what he meant. Always before when we fought, you know, we have this little antenna that says they don't mean what they say. I knew he meant what he said. And the next day he came home for lunch and he said, what have you had to drink? Well, you know, I felt real bad because I'd been drinking all those days. And I said, I've had 4 beers. And that was the first time I'd ever been honest with him how much I had to drink. So I said, will you call AA for me? Would he call AA for me? He did somersaults going into the phone. And he called AA. And they said, how is she? And he said, she's drunk, of course. And so they said, walk her around. It was rain. It was kind of misting, not a bad rain, but a misting rain. Walk her around for a couple hours and we'll be out. And so Sam and Celia came out. First of all, as we went out the door, Howard had me wrap up. First of all, I wore a costume when I was drinking. I had an old pink robe. We called it brushed rayon, and it had satin on the collar, and I never washed it, and I smoked, so it had cigarette holes in it, and I had my hair bleached, and they put a dark rinse on it to keep it from being brassy looking. And that dark rinse got on shirt collars, on my chair, on my pillowcases, and on the collar of my robe, which I wore. And I had a couple of buttons missing. And Howard would come home, and I'd have this on. Oh, and I didn't take a shower or a bath because I had read or heard someplace about a woman who was drunk and she fell and poked her eye out and fled to death in the bathtub, and that scared me. And so I didn't take a bath or a shower. I thought a shower would be just as bad, you know, I could fall and hit the whatever. And I put on this robe. I washed my hair, and I rolled it up on pink curlers, and one would go this way and one would go that way, you know, and they were hanging down. And he'd come home and he'd say, "You've been drinking, haven't you?" And I would think, "How does he know I've been drinking?" Anyway, I told him, so he made me put on my raincoat, and it was almost as horrible looking as my robe, and wrap up my hair in a scarf, and we got out on the sidewalk, and I said, "Hard people are going to see me," and he said, "It's about time someone besides me saw you." And he said, as we walked around the neighborhood, you could see the Venetian blinds going up and people peeking out. And anyway, Sam and Celia came out, and Sam was the alcoholic and Celia was an Al-Anon. And Howard, really, he thought that was the greatest thing because he could talk to her. But she said, "Does she have anything to drink?" And Howard said, "Yeah, she had a couple of bottles of wine in the washing machine." It was dangerous to turn on a switch in our house unless you checked first. And I poured them out, and she said, "Doesn't do a bit of good." She said, "If an alcoholic wants a drink, they'll crawl 3 miles to get it." And I thought, where does she hide her wings in that raincoat? Because that's the first time someone had ever said what I felt. You know, that I needed a drink and I wanted a drink no matter what. And so anyway, they talked about, I came in, I went in and out, I was kind of in a brownout, you know, and I just picked up pieces of the conversation. But they came and got me the next night and took me to my first meeting. And in Texas City, the meeting, the club, was right next, was out on the waterfront, and which was a pretty bad place to be, but that's what it was. And we walked in, and here were all these happy people. You know, they all looked so good. They were clean, and well, I was clean too, because my mother-in-law's be a lady, you know, who's still with me. Be a lady. I got so damn tired of hearing that. And I dare any drunk woman to be a lady. She can't. She can try, but she can't be. Anyway, I got all cleaned up and went, and the guy who talked, in Texas, you tell your sobriety date, and if you don't tell it, they wait for you. And so he'd been sober 22 years, and I thought, yeah, you know, liar. Nobody's been sober 22 years. And that was my first AA meeting. And we often say, if you don't drink, life will get better. Well, I didn't drink for 11 months and 2 weeks. And then I drank. And it was terrible. It was humiliating. First of all, they had a blackboard at the back of the room, and they had Helen M. 216 or whatever it was, 1 year. And they erased that. And they gave you a yellow card, and they put stars on it for every year. And I'd have a lot of stars on it now, but anyway, they tore that up. And I felt like the old B movie where the French Legionnaire gets drummed out of the corps, and the commandant goes up to him and pulls off one epaulette and slaps him across the face, and then the other epaulette and slaps him across the face and sends him out to the desert to die. And that's the way I felt. So the next time I drank, I didn't tell him. I lied about it. On December the 31st, 1964, as I told you, my husband was chief engineer, and he'd gotten a lot of liquor for Christmas. And I evidently opened up one bottle, and I fixed a drink, and I drank it. I fixed another drink, and I drank it. The third drink, I thought, Helen, old girl, what in the hell are you doing? And then I thought, I shouldn't be drinking, that's for sure. So I poured it out, and I can honestly say that's the only drink I ever poured out. And that was the last drink I took. But I lied about it, and it nearly killed me. The next year, the guilt drove me crazy. I looked for all the world like a concentration camp survivor. I had lost so much weight. I couldn't eat. I couldn't sleep. It was just that lie, that one lie. And my God, the way I'd lied all my life, you'd think that that wouldn't hurt me that much, but it did. So in September of the next year, Sam and Celia were walking down the street in Texas City, and we ran into them, and they were going to a retreat, and they wanted us to go with them. And Howard said he had another lockdown, but he thought it would be a good idea if I went. He didn't know what was the matter with me, but he knew something was wrong. So I went to the retreat. Well, first of all, another hurricane came up in the Gulf, and I thought, I can't go if it's a hurricane. And Howard had told me that. He said, if there's a hurricane here, you can't go. And so I prayed mightily for the hurricane not to hit us, and it hit New Orleans, and I cried and felt so guilty because the hurricane missed us and didn't stop. When I took my fifth step, the minister said, Helen, you don't control hurricanes. You don't control anything but your own feelings and your own actions. And so I still didn't believe him. But anyway, I went to the retreat. And on Saturday night, Dot Mooney from Savannah or from Statesboro talked, and she told about one time when Dr. John was in Lexington. She dressed her children, and she dressed her sons and sent them to Sunday school, and she wanted to go. She wanted to go to do something clean and decent and honorable, and she couldn't go. She had to stay home and drink the beer in the icebox. I'd been there. I knew exactly what she felt like. And I thought, I'm an alcoholic. Now, that is the first time I'd ever told myself, entered my inner self, that I'm an alcoholic. I'm just like everybody in this room that's an alcoholic. And so the next day, the guy who talked was a preacher, and he preached to us, and he did this. He said, you're the only honest people left in this world. And I thought, who, me? And I knew if I sat there any longer, I'd vomit. And so I got up and rushed out of the room, and Sam caught me at the door, and he said, Helen, what's the matter? And I said, since see you down by the lake, I've got something to tell her. So she came down by the lake, and I told her about that drink on New Year's Eve. And she said, she laughed, as we all do when we sponsor people, you know. She laughed, and she said, we knew something was wrong, we just didn't know what. So it took 6 hours to drive back to Texas City, or to Hitchcock. And when we got there, Howard came out to the car to get my suitcase, and I went in, and my daughter said, Mommy, what happened? You look different. And Howard took me by the shoulder and pulled me around. He says, "You do look different. What happened?" And I said, "I'll have to tell you tomorrow." So the next day, before the kids got up, I said, "Howard, remember New Year's Eve?" Well, he didn't remember New Year's Eve, you know. And he said, "Why?" And I said, "I took a drink that day and I lied about it." And he said, "Helen, if that's the only lie you told last year, that's real progress." And my life changed. That was the turning point in my life. I took the fourth and fifth step. I had taken the fourth step earlier in my so-called sobriety. We had a young minister, and he was a lot younger than we were, and I was afraid I'd upset him, so I told him a bunch of lies, you know, and it's sort of like Cinderella gone bad. And this time I took a real fourth step and a fifth step, and I poured my heart out, and it began. It was the beginning of my recovery. That's all I can say, is it was the beginning of my recovery. And that was almost 48 years ago. And the next month we were transferred to Atlanta. And I was sober, really sober for a year then. And I was the only woman, we lived in South DeKalb, and I was the only woman in that area who would make 12-step calls. And I would have to get men to go with me, because never take a step call alone. One guy said that was the last step call he'd ever make on a woman. And that was okay. But anyway, I was crying one night at a meeting, and I said, "I've tried so hard to get people sober." And the chairman looked at me and she said, "Well, you're sober." And that's true. I really learned, you know. And finally, they began to get sober, not through anything I did. I just got out of the way and let God do it. Anyway, and things changed, and it's been a great ride. I've had a great life. I'm 85 years old, and if I died right tonight, in fact, I think I'd like to die on the podium. I'd be happy. I mean, I it's been so great. I've had so much fun. I thought when I came to the program that this was the end of life, but it was the beginning. And I just have had so much fun, and I've seen so much and done so much that I never would have had I stayed on drinking. I like to end this way. This is one of our pamphlets, A Member's Eye View of Alcoholics Anonymous. And at the very end, he says, "This coming Sunday in the churches of many of us, there will be read that portion of the Gospel of Matthew which recounts the time when John the Baptist was languishing in the prison of Herod, and hearing of the works of his cousin Jesus, he sent two of his disciples to say to him, 'Art thou who is to come, or shall we look for another?' And Christ did as he so often did. He did not answer them directly, but wanted John to decide for himself. And so he said to the disciples, 'Go and report to John what you have heard and what you have seen. The blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead rise, the poor have the gospel preached to them.' Back in my childhood catechism days, I was taught that the poor in this instance did not mean only the poor in a material sense, but also meant the poor in spirit, those who burned with an inner hunger and an inner thirst, and the word gospel meant quite literally the good news. More than 16 years ago, four men, my boss, my physician, my pastor, and the one friend I had left, worked singly and together, maneuvered me into AA. Tonight, if they were to ask me, 'Tell us, what did you find?' I would say to them what I now say to you. I can tell you only that of what I have heard and seen, it seems the blind do see, the lame do walk, The lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead rise, and over again, in the middle of the longest day or the darkest night, the poor in spirit have the good news told to them. God grant that it may always be so. Thank you.